every hour. So we had, well, we had what you call worse than dogs have got it now. Dogs have got it now better than we had it when we come along. I know, I remember one night I was out after I was free and I didn't have nowhere to go. I didn't have nowhere to sleep. I didn't know what to do. My brother and I was together. So we knew a man that had a living stable there. And we crept in that yard and got in one of the hacks of the automobile and slept in that hack all night long. So next morning, we could get out and go wherever we belonged. But we were afraid to go at night because we didn't know where to go and didn't know what time to go. But we had got away from there and we were afraid to go back. So we kept slept in that thing all night until the next morning, and we got back where we belonged before the people got up. Soon the day commenced to come on break, we got out and commenced to go where we belonged. But we never done that but the one time. After that, we always, if it was away, we'd try to get back before night come. But then that was on a Sunday, too, that we done that. Now, when we were slaves, we couldn't do that, see? Mm-hmm. And if we got free, we didn't know nothing to do. And my mother, she hunted places and bound us out for $1 a month. And we stayed there maybe a couple of years. She'd come over and collect the money every month. And $1 was worth more then than $10 is now. And and the men used to work for $10 a month, $120 a year used to hire that way. Now you can't get a man for $50 a month. If you pay a man now $50 a month, you don't want to work for it.
More like $50 a week nowadays.
That's just it, exactly. They want $50 a week and they ain't got no more now, and we had then. We had nowhere, nothing. We didn't have nothing on it, just to light the cattle, just turned out and get along the best you could.
The number to call is 212-209-2950. How could you not be moved from the voice of Fountain Hughes? He died back in 1957. He's not an actor, but he was a slave. His mother, his sister, his father were slaves. And he, fortunately for him, he was never sold. He was able to stay with his mom. His father was killed. They lived as they could. He says after the Emancipation Proclamation, after they were free.
That program was brought to you on recording. You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. It is time for Hour of the Wolf. According to the schedule that was handed out to the staff, I'm supposed to be on tonight from 2 to 5 a.m. But I called our station manager, who was also our program director, and he said, oh, no, that's a mistake. You do your normal time slot. You go on at 1:30, and Lister, Burn Baby Burn Clapper, goes on at 3 o'clock. Also, I don't think any of us know how to get in touch with Lister. When he comes in at 3, I'm going to have to get that phone number on him. But that does not change the importance of what those people were saying. I'm going to repeat that phone number that they were saying, 212-209-2950. But I'm going to ask for a different method of support. They were mostly asking for regular donations, and they had that very specific premium, including some of the most important sounds to be heard from the 20th century that were broadcast through Pacifica Radio, which is a treasure. There's no denying that. But what I like pitching, and what in fact the station manager and erstwhile program director, he's the program director in between all of our interim program directors, you see. What he told me to pitch was the BAI Buddy, and that just happens to be a happy coincidence because that's what I like to pitch. The BAI Buddy. No, that's not somebody who will come to your house and hug you, although we should consider that. because we've tried most everything else. And actually, come to think of it, there are probably staff members like Lister who are quite willing to do that. But the BAI Buddy is, well, it's the installment plan. It's $10 a month. Right. Yeah, it's $120 a year. So, yeah, I'm asking for more money than they were asking you for. But you know what? I'm offering pretty much the same thing that they were offering. Because for that $10 a month to become a BAI buddy, now am I reading this right? Become a BAI buddy and get both for $10 or more per month. That's right. Okay. So in a way, you're actually, they want $180 for these two premiums that I'm going to mention. But for a mere $120 on the installment plan of $10 a month, you get the Best of WBAI thumb drive, which has, well, it doesn't have me, so it's not all the Best of WBAI, but it's, you know, a lot of the Best of WBAI. It's a lot of historic stuff, mostly. It's speeches and programs like you're hearing, interviews, and sound that we've collected through various sources through the years. And, you know, WBAI has been part of Pacifica since, pardon me, since 1960. And Pacifica has been around since 1946. We got a lot of sound. We've got the sound of the latter 20th century of the progressive politics and other politics. I love to stick a thing in people's eyes and say, you know, William F. Buckley did Firing Line here. And they go, no, he didn't. Yes, he did. As Casey Stengel would say, you could look it up. We've had William F. Buckley. We've had Abby Hoffman. We've had this. We've had that. And yes, we have me. But aside from that, despite me, we are well worth that $10 a month. $10 a month. It's like, you know, the Warner Archive channel on your Roku box. It's only $2 more than Netflix. And we give you all this radio 24/7, plus you get these two thumb drives. And I think there are other things now for BAI buddies. There's like this whole little welcoming packet. And BAI, of course, is infamous for never fulfilling the pledges, except there are members of the CAB, the Community Action Board, that have actually gone to what management calls the station. They don't have to come here to this little sweatbox at CCNY. They get this lovely location at 388 Atlantic Avenue, which allegedly we're going to move to sooner or later, if we survive. And they've actually gotten all the premiums out. Astonishing. Therefore, we ask you right now to give a phone call to area code 212-209-2950 and ask to become a BAI buddy. WBAI. We beg at intervals. No, we beg almost incessantly. That's what I think WBAI stands for. But we are begging for our lives, because who knows what's going to happen to us? Signal swap, license lease, outright sale, stuff like that. We are the single most valuable asset that Pacifica has. And if Pacifica be in deep doo-doo, Pacifica say bye-bye BAI. And Pacifica be in deep doo-doo. So we have to become totally self-sustaining. And we have done that in the last fundraising drive, and we need to do that in this fundraising drive. 212! I'm on the pulpit now. 212-209-2950. Can you feel the spirit? Put your hand to the... Anyway.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, no, that's an old John Lithgow bit that he did when he was arts director of BAI. Was he did the day J. Edgar Hoover died. He did a bit on our news. Actually, the news theme was over. And then he did his little radio drama, J. Edgar, and he did all the voices. I think he had a woman, accomplice who was, congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Hoover. You've just given pound to a 5-pound, 6-ounce rock. Yeah. I have to find my copy of that. I have his Mr. Rue's Neighbor, which was his Mr. Rogers thing. But his J. Edgar thing, which includes this business of, getting a priest to say, open your heart and feel the spirit, open your mouth and receive the flesh. And then they would arrest the priest.
Was it John Lithgow who did Mr. Rue?
Absolutely.
Oh, my.
You remember Mr. Rue?
Somebody had had a tape of it and played it. Watch it, Rue.
That's the one. And he does both voices. He's the engineer.
Both of them.
And Mr. Rue. Yeah. That's why it's totally distinct, why Mr. Rue is totally in the right channel. Mm-hmm. And the engineer, which is actually recorded in Edit B at the church on 62nd Street, Peter Zanger was the actual engineer. And for a long time, I actually thought Peasy was the voice of the engineer, since he was the engineer. But, Rue, we've got some talking to do. No, both voices were Lithgow on that. That's a wonderful, wonderful piece of unbroadcastable.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Stuff. I mean, there's no... Beth!
So, just in case people didn't know, it was a satire on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but when you say unbroadcastable, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it came close. Yeah. There were none of, we're the ones who broadcast Carlin, but there were none of those words in there. But Lithgow was with the station for about 2.5-3 years. Hmm. I was his intern. We performed together, he and I, and 8 other people. But I have photographs. They're, in fact, on, if you go to PicassaWeb.com/Jim.Freund, look for the Pooh Players. May 15th, 1973. You'll recognize me by my 2-foot-long hair. Bob Fass was Pooh. Mm-hmm. I was Piglet. Steve Post was Eeyore. Julius Lester, the former Black Panther turned rabbi, was Owl. Julius Lester has a glorious voice. Actually, I'm not sure if he became a rabbi or a cantor. All I know is that he became very, very religious and for a while was the chaplain at University of Mass at Amherst as a Jew. Not that many Black Panthers became Reb. Okay, but Julius did it. So he was Owl. Barbara Oka, who ran the Free Music Store and later became, director of events for Parks and Recreation. Nanette Raynone, who was a forming member of National Organization for Women and was our program director at the time, was Rabbit. Barbara Oka was... Rue. That's right. And Paul Gorman was the narrator and master of ceremonies. And at the end of Pooh Sticks, Ed Goodman, station manager, heir to the Bergdorf Goodman fortune, what do you call somebody who's been arrested? An ex-con. He was an ex-con because he spent 5 days in jail for refusing to give WBAI tapes of the Tombs riots over to the state authorities on the grounds that what we broadcast was transitory. And therefore, not if you heard it and you recorded it, fine, that's yours, and that can become your evidence. But something that we broadcast over a transitory medium, we did not have to turn over. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, it's not reporter's notes, it's something you broadcast. The answer is yes, go get it. Mm-hmm. But not from us. We won. But Goodman, not before Goodman, was in jail for 5 days. P.S., he never missed a staff meeting. You know, wealthy guy. So he, at the end of the piece, came out, tripped, as in, you know, tripping on a sidewalk, tripadaisied out as Christopher Robin, because we were all his fantasy. We were all his playthings. I remember the date, that it was May 15th, 72, because it was the same day that George Wallace was shot. And it was a benefit for WBAI at Hunter College with a movie from the Firesign Theater.
Came in Forever?
No. That's late.
Further on.
That's got to be like 1975 or 76.
Yeah.
It was the Martian Space Party, which had begun the campaign of Papoon for President. One organism, one vote. Judy Collins and the Mahavishnu Orchestra with John McLaughlin. And I'll try to make a quick story on that, is I knew John McLaughlin. I knew his fabulous guitarist version of Goodbye Pork Pie Hat, you know, the Mingus thing, and, you know, lightly strumming fabulous, fabulous stuff. I didn't know that John McLaughlin had discovered electricity. And we had already done the Pooh Players, and I had already, shall we say, relaxed my mind in a manner that at the time probably could have gotten me arrested. And I was leaning back against one of the big 5-foot-tall boom speakers that was on the stage, the amps, ready to listen to the lovely dulcet tones. And little did I realize that this was not John McLaughlin, but this was the premiere of the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And I think with the first note, I was propelled into the balcony.
Blew your mind in all senses.
No. The mind was already blown. This was the body being blown across the entire auditorium. Why did I bring that up?
We got there from John Lithgow. And
Lithgow. Everybody says Lithgow.
Yeah.
You say, no, it's Lithgow.
Lithgow.
One of the few imitations I can do fairly well is John Lithgow as, I forgot to mention, John Lithgow was, of course, Steve Post, if anybody knows him, from WNYC, was Eeyore. Perfect voice, perfect attitude. Steve Post really is Eeyore. And Lithgow, of course, was Tigger.
Mm.
And Lithgow's big line was, I didn't bounce him, I coughed. I don't do a lot of imitations, but John, I nailed you on that one. Wonder if he even remembers that. If he does, it's with horror. He was already well-known. He was already on Broadway. I mean, this is before The World According to Garp, before his Oscar nominations. Yeah. And didn't he actually win an Oscar?
He did win an Oscar for Garp.
Was it for Garth?
I think
where he
it
played
was
Rebecca or whatever?
Yeah, I think it
it's been
was
so many years since
Garth.
I've seen that. When Robin Williams was still funny.
Memories.
When Glenn Close was still acting. Lithgow is about to do King Lear on Broadway. He's
that will be something to see.
Yeah, I would say so. It's coming up fairly soon, in fact. But Lithgow was a member of the people who have passed through these airwaves are well worth your $10 a month, people, by calling 212-209-2950. Again, in New York and the rest of the universe. Because we know that little creatures from other planets use area codes. 212-209-2950. And we know that they would subscribe to WBAI because they know out there that we were the first radio station ever to broadcast The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in the United States 3 years before National Public Radio. It wasn't legal, but we did it. And since the fellow who did the piracy is now passed along and is in the great ether beyond, I can and will tell who the pirate was. His name was Douglas Adams.
All right.
Who came to WBAI and to KPFK, where Mike Hodel did Hour 25. And each place he went, he accidentally left these BBC transcription discs, which were 14-inch LPs. But you needed a BBC player, which we had, because we were the broadcasters in New York of the Goon Show, along with the other listener-sponsored radio station, WRVR. In fact, we traded. I had to bring the Goon Show transcription discs from the church at BAI up to the church at WRVR, from one church to the other and back. I had very important jobs at BAI, I'll have you know. I was the courier for those.
Was RVR that I actually heard the Goon Shows? I remember
yeah,
that.
They're a great station. They were wonderful. Yeah. They actually tried the interesting experiment of taking the kind of radio that we do here and making it commercial, what they called First Amendment commercial radio. It didn't last. They couldn't get the sponsors, alas. It's a shame because they were good. They had great jazz programming. Ed Beach was one of the best jazz DJs next to our own Bill Farrar. And we also had Gary Giddens and Marion McPartland. We had a good jazz lineup. But RVR did not slouch. And they also did the Goon Show and good stuff like that in them days. So anyhow, we had BBC transcription players. And Douglas Adams knew that because he knew who the BBC had deals with. And he called up our station manager, who will remain nameless. And, no, I won't call him out. The station manager thought, oh, Freund does the science fiction thing. This guy's got some science fiction radio thing he's done. And he works on the day, something called Doctor Who. So he was a script editor for this thing called Doctor Who, which I don't think had yet made it to the U.S.
When was this?
I don't remember. Oh, actually, it would have made it.
Doctor Who was this 77 or 78.
Okay, well, this is 77 or 78 because Hitchhikers is 77.
Right, yes.
And it would already have played in England.
Yeah.
So this is late 77 or early 78. Right. And I don't remember when the first Tom Baker episodes hit Channel 9 in New York.
Yeah, the syndicated versions with the narrator.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And Douglas was not yet story editor. I think Robert Holmes was at the time.
Yeah.
But Douglas was involved and making use of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop late at night. And so he brought the discs here and accidentally left them. He then went to do an interview with Mike Hodel, who was a host of Hour of the Wolf on Mondays, where I was the co-host. He was the co-host with Margot on Mondays occasionally, and I was the co-host regularly on Thursdays and Fridays. And I was the engineer, except when Mike Hodel was around, when I would be totally redundant. But Hodel moved from New York to L.A., where he was not only the news director, but he started his own science fiction show, Hour 25. We had Richard Lupoff doing a science fiction show at KPFA in San Francisco, in Pacifica. So, and he only just fully retired from KPFA in the last 2 weeks, as a matter of fact, according to what he wrote. He just joined Facebook, just friended him, and he and I had a conversation about that. And, he was with Pacifica 50 years, thereby making me a newbie with my 47 years.
Yeah. You're practically a stripling.
Well, I was 13, and he was, he just had his 70th birthday, so he would have started when he was 20. I didn't really start doing radio till I was about 18 or 19, but I was volunteering earlier doing switchboard and pledges and stuff like that. Anyway, so that's how we know the tiny little gray things from other planets like WBAI, because they were invented by Douglas Adams, who came here and left his disks behind. And I know on Wikipedia somebody posts, few people know this, but Mike Odell was the first person to broadcast hitchhikers. No, sorry. Douglas came here first, and I beat Mike by a week.
These things count.
They do, damn it. And if Mike were around, the poor man died at like age 43 or something. I don't really like a cerebral hemorrhage, something like that. He did a wonderful show. He did great radio to the point where there's still a podcast named after him, Hour 25. When he died, Ellison took his show over along with some guy named J. Michael Straczynski, of whom no good will come. Why did Straczynski just option?
Did he just... I do not know.
Repent Harlequin, said the TikTok man.
They're not going to. Are they?
Well, why not? They made In Time.
Yeah, okay. That's true. That's true.
As much as I like Andrew Nichols' capacity for good science, Gattaca was a good movie.
I had problems with Gattaca. It just seemed to me like they were trying to do a science fiction Merchant Ivory film.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that except that
You'd never find Ernest Borgnine in a Merchant Ivory, or Gore Vidal in a Merchant Ivory film. Maybe Gore Vidal, but not Ernest Borgnine.
I have problems.
And that was one of his last good roles.
Mm-hmm. Of all the Nichols films, the Nichols films, that's probably the best that he's ever done.
The Truman Show, which he wrote, and Peter Weir directed.
Right.
But even Peter Weir could not wholly contain Jim Carrey.
Nobody can.
That's the problem. He came close to a good performance.
It's the problem I have with Jim Carrey is that. In his performances, he's always on. I mean, that was the problem with The Mask. You know, he's supposed to be playing two characters. One, the milquetoast Henry Ipkiss, I think is the name.
Yeah, I don't recall. It's been so many years.
It's Henry
Ipkiss. And I was in the same condition I was with Mahavishnu Orchestra when I saw it.
Yeah. He's supposed to play Henry Ipkiss, the restrained milquetoast guy. And then he's also supposed to be the mask, the flamboyant, out-of-control id character.
Yeah.
And the thing is that when he's Ipkiss, he's still on. He's still playing, essentially, broad and out of control.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that he's never not doing that.
Yeah. That's it.
But he was almost controlled in The Truman Show, except they had to do one or two moments. There's probably less than 5 minutes where he stops being Truman and returns into Jim Carrey. Yeah. And I'm afraid those took me out of the film.
But one of them the rainstorm sequence, perhaps?
Yeah, I think so. And the other one was the one where he's cleaning the yard and he has to go and almost moon the audience. I mean, what was the point of that? Nobody's actually watching. Yeah. He doesn't know that anybody is actually watching. Yeah. And so why does he do that? Because he's Jim Carrey and he knew that Peter Weir was watching.
Yeah.
But that movie had a good cast, had a good script. Andrew Nichol
writes... It's a very good film.
Nichol writes great science fiction cinema, but he has not been consistent in pulling it off. Gattaca had some relatively minor issues, but your complaint that it's like as if Merchant Ivory did a science fiction film is my praise. It's as if Merchant Ivory did a science fiction film. They're a bad Merchant Ivory film.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm talking about, you know, the classic Merchant Ivory film.
Yes.
But it is that sort of same type of observation of a class system, except it's done with the science fiction gloss of DNA.
That, yes. Absolutely agreed. we don't disagree. And I liked the movie. I liked the new stars. I had heard of Jude Law because I saw him in some bizarre Jean Genet play on Broadway, Full Frontal. And what a cast that had.
Are you using cast as a euphemism for what went on during Full Frontal? Or
No. Help me. Body Heat.
Turner?
Yes. Kathleen Turner. Roger Rees, Jude Law, Cynthia Nixon, and somebody else equally impressive, cast of five people, doing one of the most bizarre plays I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of bizarre plays. This is the first time I'd seen Jude Law on screen before he became ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. This was Ethan Hawke, not long after he had gotten out of puberty. He had done some good films before he was out of puberty, with River Phoenix, usually.
My problem was that the science fiction gloss I did feel was exactly that. It was a gloss. I felt it was superficial. It's sort of the same problem that I have with her, is that I feel that the science fiction...
We're about to have a fight. Okay.
I would say put on those mitts,
but I'd like to start...
Why don't you start the show?
I want to pitch for 2 more minutes.
Okay, go ahead.
Because it's 1:58 and we'll start the show at 2 o'clock.
I'll bug out.
But the point is that we can have this kind of free form. You know, this is where free form goes, gang, where Dan Persons and myself can just have a conversation, segue, take it to wherever it's going, and we... Hopefully we'll get on topic, but if we don't, hopefully we'll have had fun talking. You'll have had fun vicariously listening to that talking, and therefore, good radio will have been had. And you, I trust and hope, will be joining in with that spirit. And this is something that WBAI essentially founded. It's something that can be found on some other stations, such as FMU, which does a good job and is, not going to get into the politics of the leasing agreement, but they're one of the entities that would like to lease WBAI from Pacifica. And actually, I had to say, if something that drastic had to happen, at least it would be somebody who believes in freeform radio. But freeform radio was born here. And I won't say it will die here, but it cannot flourish here. It cannot become and continue to be the place that hosts Radio Nameable, that weird programs as far as the mainstream are concerned, such as a weekly program about science fiction and things like that, can continue to be heard, where Simon Locally can hold forth on James Joyce. And the only way that it can survive is with your support. 212-209-2950 is the telephone number to call. 212-209-2950. Become a BAI buddy. It'll cost you $10 every month. It will be the fact that we can say we're getting $120 a year from blankety blank subscriber, and we get all these people that are pledging, in essence, $120 a year, is something that we can hold under our owners' noses, our Pacifica's noses, and say we, in the largest media market in the world, can be self-sustaining. And we are more valuable to you as part of you than as not. 212-209-2950. Okay, time to start the show. We've given it half an hour. But, hey, it's free form, you know? Unfortunately, the computer here is a bit free form as well. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. With me, as you've probably already heard, is Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Ciné Fantastique, and, well, what would you know, Hour of the Wolf. Stay tuned. I'm sorry that you just missed this wonderful talk we had.
Well, let's replicate it.
Yes. If only we had a replicator here, yes. Which, if people called and pledge, we'll be able to afford one real soon.
Oh, that, do they have those now?
No, but they will once it replicates the time device that. Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Okay, yeah.
I think in honor of the Academy Awards, we should address ourselves by our Travoltified name.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if you know, Slate has this app on the web now that you can put in your name.
I've heard.
I am Daniel Palmzer. Okay, and I checked yours as well. You're Jai Florzis.
But I am.
Yeah, you look like a Jai Florzis.
I've been used as one as well. That's the sad part. There were a few moments that people did not care for, and they're making a lot of fun for Travolta. But I have to say, in all honesty, my heart goes out to him. I feel that he is a brainwashed. A very good person, very nice, well-meaning person who has gone through so many reinventions of his character and his career, which I will use the word cult to which he belongs, enables him to reinvent himself so well. I mean, from Hairspray to... this, to Vinny, to this and that and the other thing. And he's had so much tragedy in his life that I can't help but imagine the worst on how that occurred.
I can imagine any number of situations that could have cropped up. His contact lenses were bothering him, and he said to himself, I'm just going to go out and wing it. I can handle this. And he gets out there.
I've got a better one. His contact lenses were like an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. They were telling him
to act normally.
Yes.
I checked a few other names, though, on the Travoltifizer, and it's like Alfonso Cuarón, who won Best Director.
God. Would have come out as an American name.
No, actually comes out as Antonio Crosford.
Ooh.
With a Z.
That would be a great pseudonym for him.
That would be the sort of thing if the film was released by American International.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
You know, that's what it would have been turned into. Quentin Tarantino would have been Quinn Tasler. The Travoltifizer seems to like Z's.
He might yeah. like that Tarantino. He's a weird dude.
And just for fun,
I actually saw him on Broadway.
Quentin Tarantino?
Yes, in Wait Until Dark. He played her. He wrote the same.
Of course he did.
Of course he did. And he did Marissa Tomei. Yeah. What did the role which mm-hmm. I saw on Broadway in its original run with Lee Remick and Robert Duvall? Believe it or not. And on Broadway, that thing was so bleeping scary. Not that Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin didn't right. do a good job.
Did they cut out all the lights? In the original stage,
the play by Frederick
Straight,
Knott, yeah.
In the original stage performance, when it was originally run, at the very end, for people who don't know it, at the very end of this, Audrey Hepburn in the film.
Yeah, I mean, we don't see the husband in the play.
But she plays a blind person at the very end. She's being stalked by this guy. The way she gets a tactical edge
is by
knocking out all the lights in her apartment. In the theater,
and all the theater.
In the theater, what they did is they cut out all the lights,
that's right.
including
the exit lights.
The exit lights.
That's right. That's right. They did that, and there were lawsuits, and there were problems, but... the mayor, I think, was it Lindsay? Lindsay would have said no problem. Mm-hmm. I think what they had to have is that they had to have people standing mm-hmm. at the exits and all that. Yeah. But for that 10-minute sequence when she mm-hmm. knocks out the last light, yes, mm-hmm. the exit lights in the theater went off when I saw it. Yeah. And that, because it's integral to the fact that you, in the theater, you are in that totally mm-hmm. dark room. And there are gotchas. There are some mm-hmm. serious gotchas, or at least one. There's a couple, but there's one gotcha that has the audience screaming. And not just faux teenager screaming. I mean, it's a shocker. It's mm-hmm. a real shocker. In a live theater situation, and yes, it's Robert Duvall, you know, and it ain't Boo Radley. It's Robert Duvall, fierce Robert Duvall. And if the lights were on, the only light that we have to see by is the light that is emanating from a mostly closed refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And you have to allow the time for your eyes to get accustomed to it. Yeah. It was a real shocker.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yes. Now, how do you mean that they changed the ending?
Well, no. I was just saying in the film, I don't think, well, because it's...
Oh, in the film, they wouldn't ever allow a movie theater to turn out the exit lights.
Not just turn out the exit lights, but in the film itself, they don't allow the screen to go completely dark.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, and you can't. Although, if you watch, like, you know, mm-hmm. if you, I saw moments of it on TCM mm-hmm. not long ago, and you can turn out the lights in your house and take the phone off the hook and just don't allow yourself for the last half hour of that movie. And when Ephraim Zimbalist walks in, mm-hmm. boo. But for the rest of the film is the play, beautifully done.
One of my favorite nasty moments, by the way, is in the film Lost Highway. Have you ever seen Lost Highway, David Lynch?
Lynch? Yeah, no, I've never seen that.
This was in, I saw this in an actual screening, so we were in the
theater.
Something
that I need you to review, by the way, not David Lynch. Yadorovsky's Dune.
Oh,
we'll get
I've
back.
Actually seen it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, great,
yeah.
great, great.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to. Actually, I was thinking.
I didn't know that.
That
it opened yet.
Yeah, it's opening this weekend.
Oh,
as a matter of fact,
I have to see it. I have to. But we'll get back.
Yeah,
to that.
We'll get
Go
back
on.
To that. Lost Highway. There is a sequence where it's in this house. The room is essentially darkened. Lynch does an exceedingly long, slow track into a darkened doorway. The camera just sort of tracks in mm-hmm. very slowly, and the screen fills with black. This goes on for at least a minute, possibly more. Screen fills with black, and he cuts to a completely stark white screen.
Yeah.
Everybody in the screening room went,
oh, yeah. Spielberg tried to pull that off
with
in Close Encounters.
Yeah, and
in the Ziegfeld Theater, in the big, right. You know, 70mm theater, yeah. It worked.
Yeah. Yeah, very well. I remember that.
Yeah. On TV, not so much, but...
yeah. I also remember at the screening I was at for that, during those black credits, as the music is just fading up, there was some guy who repeatedly screamed out, "This is BS," except he wasn't saying BS.
Yeah.
Another type of environmental experience.
This was at a screening?
Yeah. It wasn't a press screening.
This it was an all-media screening.
No, it wasn't all-media. This was the regular public screening.
Bah!
This was way back when I was a dewy-eyed youth.
Well, yeah, but it was still print and Cine Fantastique.
Oh, yeah.
This was
a long time before I loved,
and I still have my collection.
Right.
Of Cine Fantastique. About that same time, my partner Barbara Krasnoff was working on Future Life, mm-hmm. which had a similar physical format to Cine Fantastique, and they had gatefolds every issue of art by, like, Rick Sternbach mm-hmm. or, you know, one of the great science fiction artists, stuff that you would put on your wall of, you know, scenes from... Mm-hmm. Science fiction stories. One of their columnists was Ellison. It was a good magazine. It was put out by the people that did Starlog, who knew Robin Snelson and group. And they...
We're fine. We get along together. Considering the fact they're still doing better than us, so...
Yeah, well, it's different people now.
Yeah.
But at that point, they were just not Trekkers, Trekkies.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And they did not get the science fiction and the magazine.
Well, that was our gig.
Yeah,
I was at when I covered RoboCop.
Well, they weren't.
RoboCop 2. I covered RoboCop 2. I was on a press junket in Houston. Where they shot this thing, and they had, you know, everybody together, and they had, like, the Starlog people there, mm-hmm. and the Starlog guy was talking to me and going, you know, the problem with you Cine Fantastique guys is you take yourselves too seriously, and I said, yes, we do. What's your point?
Yeah.
You know, that is what we do.
Yeah,
you know, is we treat this as real bleeping stuff.
And so did Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah.
He was making brilliant satire.
Yeah.
Brilliant satire.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was satire, I'll buy that for a dollar. But anyway, I still haven't. And despite your review, I'll wait for it to come to the small screen.
It's fine. I was as I mentioned in the review, I was disappointed in it. I expected a lot more of the director because I know his work. I know the two big films that he did previous to this. He's done a number of films.
Yeah, but you see, I think that's why he was the wrong director for the project. For what they wanted. A grim, humorless, serious version, and the whole point of what Verhoeven was doing is, oh my God, it's going to be so grim. But it's funny that it's going to be so grim. It was Toxic Avenger.
Yeah. I don't think it's humorless. I don't think this film is humorless. That's
it
not
can't with that cast. Yeah.
But that's also not what he is, and that's
not
what
satirical.
He brings to it. But it's not satirical, and that's the difference.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are people who still think that Starship Troopers is serious.
Yeah, I know.
Same director, Paul Verhoeven. Yeah. But, what was the movie?
Balticon. The Balticon that they had that year, I was the guy defending Starship Troopers in a room full of libertarians.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Yeah, and at the end of
I understand that.
I thanked them for letting me live.
The Heinlein disciples would not, they probably saw that this was not Heinlein.
The
one movie that was Heinlein for the most part was Puppet Masters.
The more recent one?
Well, it was called Robert A. Heinlein's Puppet Masters. Yeah, Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland, yeah, that one.
Other
that
people one. In it.
Yeah,
and,
which I haven't
and,
seen.
And it deviated from Heinlein at certain parts because, of course, Heinlein had to come up with a method to make all the women topless. because that, in that point of Heinlein's life, that was his entire desire.
And you have a problem with that? well, maybe you do.
His method was leering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't that he was enjoying it. It was, in order to prove that you're not kneeling, you have to take off your shirt. Yeah, right. I mean, he gives bust measurements of his characters. Heinlein writes great women. Mm-hmm. When they're not at an age of menstruation, okay? Podcane of Mars, wonderful. The Granny in Magic Incorporated, fabulous. But then take, what's her name in The Moon is a Harsh mm-hmm. Mistress, Virginia, that's the real life, or anything like that, and they all turn into these brainiac, some other word with a B,
bimbos?
No. Four letters. Anyway.
Okay.
Sounds like somebody is rude.
Okay.
You know, it's a rude word the way he uses it.
Mm-hmm.
And
these days, of course, we call that fan service.
Yeah. Exactly. But anyhow. We came here largely. You had a specific proposal for a bit that you were going to record. But before you do that,
yes,
I should have done this earlier. I have announcements to make. Number one, next week on this program, Robert Freeman Wexler will be here from Ohio, and he will be our live guest. And that's because he's coming to New York for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. And, well, of course, you have to attend that. I produce it. Admission is free, although we will ask for donations if you can afford it, but we will turn nobody away. And we have two utterly wonderful readers. Chandler Klang-Smith, who, if you were listening to this program, I guess she was on about, 3 months ago at this point, and wonderful new voice in the field, and her first novel is out called Golden Land After Dark, and is a dark circus book. Coincidentally, and it really is coincidental, Robert Freeman Wexler also has a dark circus book. And he is a more established writer, having been around for many years. Graphically gorgeous books, mostly from PS Publishing. I don't actually have all the materials in front of me. I'll get them later and I'll repeat them later. What I will tell you is this. It's this coming Tuesday, whatever the date is. It's the 11th. Tuesday the 11th, Robert Freeman Wexler, Chandler Klang-Smith, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. See if I can get to the finish line. Just saying what it is. People with three names at venues with seven words. 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and the Prince and the street formerly known as Prince. For more information, you can go to Facebook and look up NYRSF. You know how to spell that. That's NY as in New York, Review of Science Fiction, NYRSF Readings. And you can join that group, or you can just go to my webpage, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and you'll follow the links. You'll drill down, as we used to say in software design, drill down to see the link for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Click there and you'll see photographs of the readers and all kinds of spiffy stuff. So Tuesday, 6:30, opening doors start. Reading starts at 7, 138 Sullivan Street. Be there. And Robert will stay overnight and he will do Hour of the Wolf the following week. Let me just mention the next two Nearsif readings very quickly. April, the second Tuesday in April, will be a tribute to Robert Sheckley, one of my favorite writers of all time. And attributing the tribute will be his daughter. I love to have daughters of great writers around. We've had Noel Sturgeon, we've had, well, lots of great daughters of lots of great writers. In this case, we'll have Elisa Quitney, who is a best-selling romance writer. But when she writes supernatural romance, which is a genre unto itself, she uses her real name, Elisa Sheckley. And with Elisa Sheckley, toasting Robert Sheckley, will be Henry Wessels, antiquarian, and some writer named Rudy Rucker. And some writer from Philadelphia. After I talk to him, I'll say his name on the air, but he won't turn this down, I don't think. Anyway.
Beats doing a reading in Philadelphia.
Oh, yes. He does those, too. I think he's reading at Lunacon, though. Oh, Lunacon. We should probably mention Lunacon.
Yeah, that's true.
Lunacon was a week after next?
It's
not this week.
No, it's the...
Thank God.
It's the week of the... weekend of the 14th. It's
weekend after
this
one.
I, unfortunately, will not be there this
time. That's unusual. I usually see you there.
Yeah. Personal reasons.
Okay,
Cannot.
Last year, you only made it for one day for...
No. I was able to...
That was 1 year, yeah. But at any rate, yeah. It's neither
Russ, but in my absence, Russ Handelman, my friend, will still be running the cartoon show.
Oh, excellent. Most Friday excellent. Evening. Okay, so. Can I make requests?
Yes, sure.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, for specific cartoons.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
You know, number one, anything Warner Brothers before 1950.
He's probably got that going.
Why has that stuff disappeared? Why can you not find any Looney Tunes or Merry Melodies pre-1950?
I'm not sure. They are running them on Cartoon Network.
No, they are not.
No?
No, they are not. Believe me, not Boomerang, Cartoon Network.
It's the post-50s ones.
Yes. Yes, it's only the post-50s ones.
There was a whole weird situation about copyrights, which company owns what copyrights? MGM owns some.
Yeah, there's weird.
Turner got some.
Well, MGM owned Turner and Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And then that got split up because AOL screwed everything up. Yeah. It was all very, very weird. But it's not a copyright issue, I don't believe. I believe the issue is... this is my own belief, is that all of the cartoons up to a certain point were very timely. They had references to Rudy Valley and Frank Sinatra and FDR and the Depression and politics of World War II and politics of the era. And the post-1950 ones are free of anything timely.
Mm. Not quite, But
I can't think of any post.
The Honey Mousers.
Although everybody still knows the Honeymooners.
Well,
there
are still cultural references.
Yeah, but
not all of them are out of date.
But the Carl Stalling music, you know, is that somebody sees somebody who they like. The music in the background would be "If I Could Be with You Tonight."
Know. You know, the animators always had to be careful to keep from Carl Stalling if a female character was going to be wearing something in red,
because
it would automatically swing into the lady in red.
As long as it's within the Warner Brothers ownership of repertory, which is vast.
Yeah.
Which is vast. Carl Stalling could take from Raymond Scott. He could take from all the movies. Anything from Warner and Dubin.
The thing is about a lot of the cultural references, first of all, there are even more cultural references than you realize, because they have become so ingrained and associated with Looney Tunes to begin with. But
any
time a character goes, "I'm a bad boy," that wasn't Looney Tunes. That was Lou Costello.
That's right.
Originally.
But that's even late material. Yeah. I mean, we're talking The amount of vaudeville stuff, the amount of Encanter, the Al Jolson, and a lot. And this is definitely an issue of racist material.
Wow.
I mean, I was watching a tune on YouTube just last night. Mm-hmm. Not last night, before I came here, in which it was perfectly fine. But as people went in a chase scene, there was a wood pile. And as the car blew the wood away, underneath the wood pile was a minstrel.
Yeah.
And there's good reasons why you don't broadcast that today. Although my belief is that you should broadcast that today with disclaimers and with explaining to people what the racism of the era was.
There has been an ongoing controversy.
Are in favor of that.
I forget what it's called. I think it's called something like the Censored Seven. There are like
11.
Censored 11, yeah. There are 11 Looney Tunes that will not air anywhere. And a
lot of those are mild compared to some of the ones that they do show.
Yeah.
I mean, the World War II ones are especially vicious.
Well, yeah.
But
yeah.
the worst of all are post-World War II. You would think it's earlier, but it's actually when the war was over and blacks were coming into the workforce and whites were afraid that they were going to lose their jobs. Women had to go back home and were only allowed to be homemakers. They couldn't work anymore. It's up to you to keep your home fine so your man can go out and earn a living. And, oh, yes, your man is white. Blacks in the workforce were a major threat to white movie-going and other audiences. And so even Tex Avery cartoons became particularly racistly vicious about 1947-48.
At that point,
I watch a lot of cartoons.
You're talking about Tex Avery at MGM, though.
Yes.
That isn't Warner Brothers anymore. Warner Brothers
did some bad ones. That's the era in which they had Bugs Bunny being hunted by
all this and Rabbit Stew.
Is that the one with the Stephen Fetchett character? Is that just the
yeah? That's
oh, okay.
the one.
Oh,
that's
God,
the
that's
one.
Horrible.
Yeah,
that's horrible.
And that's
it's not even funny.
No, it isn't. That one is particularly problematic. The one that usually gets held up as an example is Coal Black and the Seven Dwarfs.
No, you know, I
and
love
it's,
that.
It's
one.
A yeah.
That is a masterpiece, Bob Clampett.
It is a very, very good cartoon. It is a
it's
masterpiece.
It's an excellent cartoon. It is what it is. We are talking, by the way, from 135th Street and Amsterdam Avenue right now, 137th Street. I'm not sure how many blocks we are from the Cotton Club. But we're not far.
We're pretty close.
We're pretty close to the Cotton Club right now. There is an argument to be made that for its era, it was respectful.
This was a
that
time
the racism when, in it is the racism of society, not of the cartoon.
Yeah. This was the time when if you had African-American characters in your cartoon, the voices were being done by white actors.
Well, of course.
Bob Clampett went out of his way to cast African-Americans doing the voices in Coal Black.
That's right.
And the Seven Dwarfs. The whole motivation.
There's no mimicry. The gorgeous young lady in there just happens to resemble Lena Horne in Cabin in the Sky.
And I believe was...
Which is not a racist film.
I think was Dorothy Dandridge's sister, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think.
Oh,
I
buy that, yeah.
The thing is that Bob Clampett and I think a number of Warner Brothers artists were regulars at the jazz clubs.
Well, of course. Not as much as the Fleischers were, but the Fleischers were in New York.
Yeah.
Well, those guys were New Yorkers out in L.A.
Yeah.
But the Fleischers were the real urbane ones. And they were always, of course, throwing Yiddish humor in there on purpose. They were just multicultural.
Want to hear my theory? I've got a weird theory about another Warner Brothers cartoon. Book Review?
Yes.
You remember there is...
That's the one with the worm.
It's the one with Daffy Duck. It's the one with Daffy Duck. And
there are several book or magazine based. Right. There are about three or four, we need to explain to listeners, that are all like, you know, you're sentenced to life, and it's the magazine. You know, you're going to do time. You can't do this to me. I'm a citizen, which is, of course, the end of Lucia de Lammermoor.
But
and first act, sorry, for end of the first act. Anyway,
but in that cartoon, Daffy Duck appears in it, and disturbed by the ruckus that the other books are making, he puts on this zoot suit and essentially does
Danny Kaye.
He does the Danny Kaye Russian character.
Yes, except that Danny Kaye was doing a Cab Calloway.
Yeah. Oh, that, what's
well the zoot suit?
The zoot suit.
Who designed the zoot suit?
But with the Russian dialect.
Designed the zoot suit.
Yeah, with the Russian dialect.
Yeah, that that's Danny Kaye's Tchaikovsky routine.
Yeah. But so he goes into this monologue, you know, jazz music, you know. We used to sit on the porch strumming our samovars and drinking from our balalaikas. And then he goes into, for some reason, he says, and then there was La Cucaracha. Ah, La Cucaracha. So round, so firm, so fully, fully packed. And I, what the hell does that mean? And my theory
is... LSMFT?
Well, here's the thing, is that they frequented...
I think it was LSMFT, wasn't it?
Lucky Strike means fine, round, tobacco. So firm. But here is the point. That's, that plays into what I'm thinking.
That's what killed my uncle were Lucky Strikes. Go on.
Clampett, who directed this cartoon, was a frequenter of the jazz clubs.
And by the way, he came on WBAI at least a few times, but go on.
And, of course, you know, and he hung out with the jazz musicians. And the jazz musicians, of course, their intoxicant of favor in between gigs was the herb.
I have news for you.
Yeah.
You didn't have to go... Well,
I didn't have to go the overland route.
Yeah, well, no, let's put it this way. I worked at a place with a classic 40s jazz band. They were older, but they were them. And this was in Midtown Manhattan, and they still do dweed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. But
how they forced me. They must have forced me.
You struggled. You struggled mightily. We respect your battle. Here's the thing, though. What do you call the stub of a marijuana cigarette? A roach? No, you call it a roach.
Hal Roach. Never mind. I had to make a movie joke.
Okay, bringing that in.
A joke almost as old as Hal Roach was. Here's what.
It's called a roach, and a roach in Spanish is La Cucaracha.
Yeah.
Ergo, so round, so firm, so fully packed. He's talking about dope.
There is a Warner Brothers cartoon filled with frogs in a swampland. I'm trying to remember the name of this. It was so shocking. I had it on my very first Android phone. It was actually the droid. That was the one. It was the droid. Actually, the T1 was the first, but it was the first droid. I now have my new Moto X. And
which you guard covetously.
Well, yeah, and I can actually receive...
Like Smaug and his gold.
Indeed. I can actually receive messages here. I mean, I have listeners who send me tweets and stuff during the show. And
are people tweeting?
And I can... they usually do. Hmm. They usually do. And...
Hello, people.
Or actually, it's often Facebook messages. The point is, I can actually get them here, which with my last phone, I couldn't.
Yeah.
But at any rate, there's this cartoon. With various, there's a Fats Waller frog, you know, at the piano. There's some great, great music. Some kind of a Minnie the Moocher-like wedding going on. And all this stuff. And there is one, and all of this is this great jazz, this great stuff. All this wonderful Harlem-based music. Incredible, fabulous stuff. And at the end, as the whole thing is going crazy, there's one frog who looks at the audience, winks. You have to watch this frame by frame to see it. And he takes out a hypodermic, he shoots up in his arm, looks at the audience, and winks big time, like, this is a good thing.
Fleischer's.
No.
No, not
Warner. That's Warner
Brothers.
That's
Warner's?
That's a Warner's. I don't remember if it's Clampett or whom. But that's a the one
sounds
I'm
sounds like it's early Warner. Sounds
no,
like
it's not that early. It's really? Full color.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I have to remember now. Maybe somebody will remember and call either tweet me at Jim Freund or call me at 212-209-2900. If you call with anything but the answer to that question, I don't care who you are, you will be hung up on. It's the only reason I'm giving out that phone number. Is in fact, I won't even take the call on the air. I will just pick up the phone.
Okay.
because I don't want people holding forth on off-topic issues. But it's an amazing cartoon.
Rand Paul, 2016.
Yeah, right. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Do you have trolls? Do you have trolls on radio?
Except that this is... Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, God. In fact, I miss them. One of my best died. Monroe
Indeed.
Littman. Yeah, yeah. He was one of the greats.
Yeah.
He really was. He was. And you would appreciate, you have really appreciated Monroe because he designed movie posters for a living.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean for big studios.
Yeah,
he was doing serious, real stuff. And, okay, let's see. Hi there, you're not on the air. Wyoming not?
What?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Gary. Okay, take care. Bye-bye. A well-known fan who's on delay. And he is often on delay. Wyoming not is the woman in the moon is a harsh mistress.
Oh, okay. Wow.
See you at Lunacon, by the way.
That's some freaking delay, buddy.
That's the red-headed ace is who that is. There are fans who know exactly who I'm talking about. He's had zines dedicated to him because he's such a wonderful personality.
Mm.
That's
a time slip is what that was. It's
scary.
Can I talk about gravity? Or can we talk about gravity?
The gravity of the situation.
Yeah,
that's why you're here.
That's why I'm here, because I just wanted to make this point, and I'll condense it a little bit more than
I would. No need, because you're originally just going to record like a five-minute
rap. But usually when I do the five-minute thing, I'm able to
I will try to shut it down. It's
difficult. Don't worry about it. You know, here's the thing.
Here comes Lister, though, but keep going.
Hi, Lister.
No, he's actually all the way down the hall. But
here's the thing: is that first off, let me say, my thing, and if you've listened to the CineFantastic podcast, you know that my take on it is, I don't really care about this. I don't really care about this. And then it gets around to awards time season, and son of a gun, I care.
Yeah,
I discover I still care about this thing, so I can't get rid of it. That way. So while I tried to take things in stride, and there were certain wins at the Oscars this year where I said, what you going to do? When it came time for Best Director and Alfonso Cuarón, director of Gravity, won, I screamed my guts out because for me, this basically was a confirmation of a thesis that I felt about Gravity from the get-go. Approaching film, my feeling about technology in film and new technologies in film is that they should exist as a way of expressing the story. There should be some reason, some story reason for having this technology in this type of film, and you want to think about something.
Just
like,
put a footnote on this, because when you're done, I will come back and say this. I have now figured you out. I've totally figured you out.
If we don't do it during the show, you can psychoanalyze me afterwards. I'm interested.
No, but it's
to
part
you.
Of the show, because it's okay, part of what okay, you're saying right
okay,
now.
Okay. So in any case, you know, think about things like Lawrence of Arabia. You wouldn't have that film without...
without David Lean's vision of the big screen.
Yeah, the big screen. Or Wizard of Oz and Technicolor, that sort of thing. My problem with 3D and large format film, in other words, IMAX, is that we haven't really seen a film that justified itself through the technology. I suppose some people would hold up Avatar for that. That didn't particularly work for me.
I do have two that I would name.
Okay, well, maybe we can go into that. Roger Ebert essentially gave up on 3D. He basically just shrugged his shoulders and said, this is just a gimmick. That's all it's ever going to be. I haven't been quite that willing to let go of it. And when Gravity came along, this, I felt, was proof positive of that. This was a film that was designed for large format 3D. It was its best evocation. And everything that was done in that film was done to service the fact that this was going to be a large format 3D film. And so the fact that we saw that Gravity swept essentially almost all of the tech awards.
Oh, yeah.
Almost all of the tech awards, at least the ones that it was nominated for.
Although I think Llewyn Davis should have taken for sound.
I still agree with Gravity.
The sound was magnificent in Gravity, but Llewyn Davis was all live music performed on stage. Very difficult to do. No studio.
I would agree with that. And so, you know,
sound editing, Gravity, but sound. I preferred. Now, I'm not going to say what's better. I preferred Llewyn Davis.
And by the way, amongst all those wins for Gravity, I was really happy that Stephen Price won for score, because that score did a lot of heavy lifting for a film where the environment essentially denied you of the typical sound effects. And the score worked big time for that. And here is the thing, is that when Cuarón won, it was... Usually what happens with these sort of things is that people have been dismissing Gravity as the popular summer film, even though it was released later in the year. But that's the way people have dismissed it. And usually the people go, well, you know, it's going to win all the technical awards, and that's going to be the consolation for it. The fact that Cuarón won meant, at least to me, it means that it was recognized that this is a holistic thing, is that all of these elements were coming together.
He won an award that Kubrick failed to get.
Yeah, exactly. It was all of this was coming together under the vision of the director to express, you know, this unique story told in this unique way under these unique technologies. You know, and I don't know what's going to happen with, like, 12 Years a Slave, what the longevity is going to be. I suspect that in the future, Gravity is going to be studied for how it uses its technologies to tell a story using three dimensions.
In a way, surpassing Avatar.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I wanted.
Absolutely, totally agree with you. I've got about five comments. Comment number one, name a bad film by Cuarón. Trick question.
Yeah. Well, yes, true.
As far as I'm concerned, he was the best director in the Harry Potter series. Yeah. I mean, he brought gravitas.
Yeah. His was the best Harry Potter film.
Thank you. Azkaban is the best Potter film.
Yes.
I mean, greater stuff happens at the end. It's very satisfying.
In terms of a film, in terms of filmic storytelling.
Prisoner of Azkaban remains the best. The best. Yes. Put film by film.
Yes.
Cuaron's film is the best.
Yes.
Yes.
No argument.
Children of Men. Not a great movie, but a really thoughtful one of serious science fiction. Well conceived, well portrayed.
And also, in some ways, not to denigrate it at all or to diminish it, but also in some ways a dress rehearsal for the techniques that he would use in Gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In particular, the storytelling techniques that he would
absolutely.
Use.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a brave thing with two on-camera people, one of whom is only... Well, forget spoilers. One of whom is only in the film for a limited period of time.
Yeah.
Although it makes a lovely comeback.
Yes.
Closer to the end. And then there's two off-screen voices, right?
Yeah,
Ed Harris and somebody else.
Yeah, and that's about it.
I think it's actually Cuaron's son, isn't it? Or at least he made a movie. He made a short subject about that other voice.
Yeah. Oh, did he?
Oh,
I haven't seen
that. Oh, my
that.
God. He made a 7-minute movie. That's the other end of the conversation.
What? Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's on YouTube.
It.
It's on YouTube.
It. Yeah.
Look, I forget his name. Is it
Cuaron's
son?
Yeah.
Who co-wrote the screenplay,
co-wrote
by the
way. Screenplay and...
He got up during the Academies. And by the way, when people talk about milestones of the Academy Awards, did anybody bother pointing out this is the first Mexican director to win Best Director?
What was it?
And it's not a foreign language.
The New York Magazine's
Vulture
pointed it out.
Yes, I would leave it to them.
Yeah. Okay. Jonas Cuaron.
That's it. Okay, so that was comment number one. Comment number two, go to Flickr. Look for the NASA feed on Flickr and look up Gravity. They've done their own ripoff. Only one problem. Mm-hmm. They didn't use any special effects.
Shot on location.
On location. They even have pictures of the guy, like in the cone of the of the not destroyed space station, mm-hmm. taking pictures of people doing what they do in Gravity, including some. There is a picture of an ocean of Earth, and in the distance, and these are huge TIFF files, mm-hmm. huge pictures, and in the distance you see a dot, and if you take your computer and zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, you realize that's a person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, wow. So I'm sorry, Alfonso, but you've been outdone. It took a little bit more effort. But on location, they did a nice job ripping you off. But it took all of NASA to do it. Beautiful pictures, amazing photography.
I forget who it was, but there was some comedian a few days ago who was talking about Gravity and summed it up as being the entire film was essentially every date you ever had with a stripper, which is basically curled up in a fetal position waiting for George Clooney to call.
Yeah, okay. There have been a lot of Clooney jokes, starting with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, saying Gravity is proof positive of George Clooney doing anything he can to get away from dating a woman his own age.
Mm.
Right. To which... hey, Lester, to which apparently, Clooney said, you're on the list. You have awakened the bear. And Clooney has a reputation for being a very effective practical joker.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah, so so it's like, okay, they're on notice.
Yeah.
But here is the biggest point that I wanted to make when I said, I got your number.
Right.
You are about artistic integration.
Yeah.
The reason that you had issues with her that I did not have, that you had with, what was the other thing we were talking about earlier?
Gattaca.
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 In each case, your issue with the story was that you saw the science fiction story as simply a tool.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
A tool, a method by which to tell a different story. Mm-hmm. For me, this is a good thing, is that only by science fiction, only from the alien viewpoint can one come in, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You like it to be integral.
Yes.
You want it to, in story, in 3D, in the movie making, in the art itself, if you could remove it and it would fall apart, then it doesn't belong there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that a fair statement when I say I've got you covered?
You have called me quite accurately.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't denigrating.
No,
wasn't
no.
Wasn't intended to be by
not
any
taken,
means.
Not taken that way.
I like simile. I like metaphor. You prefer holistic. I think that's...
Yeah, yeah. That's
our argument.
That's exactly
that's
it.
That's the arguments we've had right there summed out.
Yeah. That's it. That's it.
I thumbed it, yeah.
I had the same problem. I forget the name of the TV series. It started out as a movie, became a TV series. It was about these alien slaves who became integrated.
Alienation.
Alienation was the same problem I had with Alienation. You know, it was a metaphor for the racial divide.
Yeah.
And my feeling was, well, why don't we just...
How did you feel about District 9?
District 9, I actually liked.
Ah, and you see, that's how I felt about District 9.
Yeah.
And whereas Alien Nation, I really liked.
Mm.
And I think that's it. You see, I like the metaphor.
Yeah.
And you like the... I'm trying to avoid the word integration because that has overtones.
Yeah. But we're talking in terms of...
Integral.
Integration
as an integral to the art that is being made.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Yes.
And that, you see, because I agree that her is but a device.
Mm-hmm.
If in her, the AIs did not transcend to the next Alan Watts 2.0 level,
mm-hmm.
It's very important that it's Alan Watts. That escapes a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because it is really obscure.
Yeah. it certainly went over my head.
Yeah, but you didn't engineer his show.
Yeah.
I did.
True that.
When I mentioned it to Margot Adler, who loves her as much as I love her, I said, and the thing about Alan Watts, she said, oh my God! Who else in the world gets that? And it's really, I mean, it's more obscure than an MST3K comment, you know? It's really... and that's
That's pretty damn obscure.
It's on that level.
Yes,
it really is. But the thing is that, as I say, if they didn't transcend and go away,
mm-hmm.
then it would be necessary for Spike Jones to find another reason to make them go away.
Yeah.
Because the whole point is... that they go away. As Manola Dargis said, and I did this rant with you once before, and I did 2 weeks ago, it's not about her. It's about him.
Which is fine. I fully understand that, you know.
Yeah. And it is a metaphoric movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I felt...
Gattaca, not so much. I don't think it was as much of a metaphor.
Not as much, but
oh
I do. I do have problems with Nichols' regard for what science fiction is. Here again, it's a question of treating it as a holistic thing. It's a question of treating it as an integral part of the story rather than the veneer. And I don't think Nichols quite approaches integrating it into the story.
Yeah. And I really feel both her and Gattaca,
mm-hmm.
the science fiction was almost invisible. It was, I thought it was integral in the sense that you didn't, another movie that was a little bit like that in form, The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Hmm.
Okay.
Long time ago.
Long time ago,
have seen that. So.
It's been a while since I've seen it as well, but I just remember so beautifully that minor little things that we look at David Bowie and he turns his head and it's a little bit sunnier where he turns his head to and his glasses get darker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just little and the camera does not call your attention to this fact.
Yeah.
It just happens. It's now to me that was integral. Yeah. My God. You know, I didn't get around to telling people what the Ray Bradbury
The Ray Bradbury Awards,
which are Pacific Rim, Hunger Games, Her, Gravity, Europa Report, and what I considered so-so episode of Doctor Who.
I'm real glad to see Europa Report.
You liked that.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. That was That shared with Gravity the number one spot on my top 10 list.
Yeah, and Gravity are mine. But they're so totally different kinds of cinema. Yeah. We both dissed Smog.
Smog, yeah. Which I thought was on this list and fortunately was not.
But you know what?
We gotta go.
We have 1 minute left. Less than. I mean, if you look at the schedule, Lister, you will see that I'm on till 5. You're not even on today. But I called Berthold and he made sure that we're on our normal schedule. And next week, no matter what you read, Berthold says. And what Bertie says, we do. Persons.
Can I plug my website?
CFQOnline.com. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I'm at OurWolf.com. Not very calm, but we try. And .hyper, I think, is my extension. And I'll be back next week with Robert Freeman Wexler. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming over these airwaves in but moments. Well, I'm doing your show next week? Holy fud. Okay. I'm going to have to deal with that. Okay. So I'll be on from 1:30 till 5 next week. Okay. News to me, but hey. Well, I better get off the air then, because guess what? Steel Eye's already over, and it's all yours. Have a good morning. Take care.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. The red part of the balloon spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, or that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. We'll be right back.
murder's internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm messy attack. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Right here at 212-209-2950 is the number. 212-209-2950 is the number. The Begathon continues right here at 99 Cinco. $10 a month. The buddy system works, y'all. $10 a month, 12 months. Sign up right now at 212-209-2950. Yes, sir.
Nada sigue igual, no hay creación perfecta. No te das cuenta, somos poca cosa. El movimiento no conoce la pausa. Todo everybody viene a bailar, todo el mundo viene a cantar. Dile a tu papá, dile a tu mamá, que everything's gonna be alright. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución.
revolución. Me fui caminando para las cuatro direcciones. Acabé con mis ideas y mis ilusiones. Me limpió la vida del peso de mis errores. Ahora les doy la palma y veo los colores. Hay gente por la calle, se visten con disfraces, se quitan la careta y se le ven los dientes. Otros parecen brutos con cara de animales, pero tienen corazón y alma de reyes.
Yeah, peace and love shall abide, equal rights and justice. Tell your mama, tell your papa, everything's gonna be alright.
Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución.
No, no, we woke this morning, couldn't even find tea. Me still keep the faith up in the Almighty. True light and power on the Holy Trinity. Don't try testing powers, cause it's infinity. We work hard, feel we daily bread. Yes, we work hard, feel we daily bread. Boom, we work hard, feel we daily bread. Every work hard, feel we daily bread. Love we work.
Hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución. Tú me estás hablando de la revolución, pero yo quiero que me hables de tu revolución.
List alive, the proletariat that burns imperialist flag to ashes before 5 o'clock right here at 99.5. Diez minutos after 3 o'clock right here at 212-209-2950, y'all. Let's do it.
Esta es la prueba, que nadie se puede copiar, no.
99.5.
Ya no queda tiempo. A punto de caer. ¿A dónde es que mira? ¿A dónde es que mira? Si no puede ver. ¿A dónde es que mira? ¿A dónde es que mira? Si no puede ver. Ya no lo puede mantener. Secreto no, no hay sentido en insistir. Guarden sus armas, a nadie dan de comer.
Yeah. List alive right here, 99.5, as his imperialist majesty Barack the First tries to pull off a coup in the land of Chavez, y'all. 99.5, list alive right here, 212-209-2950. If only we could get 3 telephone calls at the body level, which is like, say $5. No, make it $10. Yo, yo, take it from the top right here. The body system. You call up 212-209-2950. You say, Lister told me to boom, boom, boom. Sign up and support the super pack that watches your back. Pacifica Radio, WBAI 99.5.